Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. We are back with Mike Sharma to talk about, that's right, ATLS, because, well, that's what Mike has been on. So I feel like this is continuing the series. We're on episode 2 now to talk about chapter 2, which is all about airway and ventilatory management. So, Mike, what do you think of all of this?
You know, we go with a paradigm of A, B, C, D, E for ATLS. And I think it's really important that when we are confused or the patient is decompensating, you don't know why, you go back to the A, B, C, D, E. A is airway. This is a great place to start. I think that's from Mary Poppins, right? Let's start at the very beginning. It's a very good place to start. That's part of the song.
Yes. No, I got the song.
Okay.
I was taking a drink, so I'm like trying to laugh at the same time without spitting out water. And I'm keeping that in too.
Great. Love it.
So we got our ABCDE, airway, breathing, circulation, disability, and environment exposure, right? That's our ABCDE.
Correct.
And like the first part of that is the airway. And so this is our first chapter to talk about how we do our primary assessment. And I think it's a big one for this reason, because it's vital. Like airway, if you cannot control and secure that airway, really not much else is going to happen afterwards. And we talked about how massive hemorrhage needs to be approached even before that. But realistically, hopefully that massive hemorrhage is under control very quickly and you can move on to your airway.
Yeah, I really debate about what should come first here. The airway is in the official ATLS book. That's what we're covering. So I think we just go ahead and dive right in.
All right, so let's hit it off. Where should we start, Mike?
You know, I think, again, with our intent of wanting to make sure that people are prepared for the test and just have a baseline knowledge of where we start here, I want to hit some of the things that the text really seems to emphasize. And it's funny, one of the first things I would emphasize, I feel like, is the most controversial thing in the entire chapter. Supplemental oxygen must be administered to all severely injured trauma patients. Like, wow. I have a hard time when people say never, always, and here it was, I kind of blew through it, must in medicine. Chip, what do you think about that? Supplemental oxygen must be administered to all severely injured trauma patients.
Yeah, so I even made the comments as we're going through like this Google Doc that we're keeping all of our notes on. I was like, but what is an acceptable O2 saturation? And what's an acceptable range that is normal? Because I agree. I hate the nevers, the always, the musts, and stuff like that, because it is extremely rare in medicine to actually have that. And I think this is one of those times where you could really cause some harm if you deliver too much oxygen. Now, is that going to happen often? Probably not. But I would be highly concerned about that. Now, if you say severely injured, maybe you're talking about, okay, that they're most likely hypoxemic, but not always. I have seen plenty of trauma patients who were quote unquote severely injured, but did not necessarily have an issue with their oxygen saturation. So no, I don't feel like every patient should be given it. I find it interesting that that's one of the things that ATLS has emphasized though.
Yeah, I think that the severely injured thing must be emphasized here. And it's still not a must, because same with you. I've seen people missing, you know, two or three of their four limbs, but guess what? Their airway and their breathing are fantastic. Exsanguine hemorrhages was controlled, and they are oxygenating and ventilating well, despite the massive polytrauma they've experienced here. So I think that there are studies abound out there that suggest hyperoxia is damaging for a multitude of acute care conditions, including sepsis, including stroke, including MI, and yes, including trauma. So I think those studies are out there. I think at best, there's mixed suggestion that hyperoxia is good for TBI. But in general, I think hyperoxia is something to be careful about. And this red text in the book should be taken in the real world with a grain of salt.
I would completely agree. So let's answer the next appropriate question that is extremely common. Who do you intubate?
Right. Well, I think that clearly someone who can't manage their own oxygenation and ventilation should be intubated. That's kind of like a dumb thing to say here. But I think the next thing to say there is that there's a concept in the military of staying ahead of the aircraft. My first unit I was in the military was a medical evacuation battalion. And so I was with a lot of pilots, and they shared this concept with me. The idea is that you always want to be ahead of the aircraft in the sense that you're not reacting to the aircraft. You're anticipating problems during your flight, and you are proactively taking steps to eliminate those problems or mitigate the problems during your flight. So how does that relate to this? When you have conditions that are not currently compromising someone's airway, but may imminently do so, you want to get ahead of that patient, and you want to consider intubation or other definitive means of airway control for those patients. So I'm talking about things like trauma to the face, the neck, the throat, burns that can rapidly cause swelling to the face, the neck, the throat here. So it's not just a patient who right now needs ventilation, but a patient who may imminently need that. You want to consider that early.
I'd agree with all that. And I'd add in the part too about, like you said, the anticipated course. That's not always just necessarily like, is that person going to decompensate, but also what's going to be the care from here? And especially when you've got patients who are in extreme amounts of pain and, you know, kind of deciding, okay, this person is in so much pain, to give them the proper control of pain needed may be sedation. If we're going to go into sedation on a severely injured patient, maybe we should go ahead and secure that airway. So it's one less thing we have to worry about right now.
Yeah, and we've talked on a previous podcast about how important that is, that pain control, and how inadequate pain control can actually worsen this patient's course. So I totally agree with that.
All right, so what's the next part?
Right. I think that we're in A, right? We're in the first part of our primary assessment. And so how do you assess the airway? I think it's, you know, relatively easy. When you walk up to somebody, you just kind of get close to them and you start talking to them. And that was always my first step when my medics would haul a patient into the trauma bay and honk, down goes the stretcher on our stretcher stand here. I'd get as close as I could to the patient's head and kind of put one hand on their radial pulse, and I would just start talking to them and say, hey, what's going on? My mic, I'm going to be taking care of you today. What happened to you? And within literal seconds, I can determine so much from this patient. I'm watching, are they ventilating? Are they speaking? Is their speech appropriate? And that way, very quickly, I'm assessing, is there air going in and out? Just from them talking, I know there's air going in and out. How are they speaking to me? Are they mentating well? That suggests that ventilation and airway is adequate to maintain brain perfusion. So that's a very powerful thing too, just to talk to our patients there.
I actually do the exact same thing. And when I teach my students trauma, this is actually the same exact thing I tell them about. I do caution them about radial pulses, which I think we'll talk about more in the coming chapters here, that while not perfect, it can give you at least a rough idea of peripheral perfusion, because you're getting their idea of central perfusion, because if they're aware and they're alert and they're talking to you appropriately, okay, you know, they're perfusing well enough to do those things. So I want to know also peripheral perfusion, how well is that going? So the radial pulse is still kind of helpful for me in that sense, not the archaic way of judging blood pressures, but again, that's a whole separate chapter, but I think it's worth mentioning right here just real quick.
Yes, I totally agree. We've even talked about that just offline previously, that kind of old medic teaching of, you know, X pulse at a certain location equates to X systolic blood pressure, not borne out in the literature here, but it's a good rough estimate of things.
Okay, so we've talked to that person, and maybe we can tell both by their trauma and the way they're looking, and they're not really talking to us very well, that this is someone who is going to need the airway controlled. What do you think about how to control that?
Right. So the traditional response here is to perform and to establish what's called a definitive airway. And so that's something you're going to hear about a lot in ATLS. And it's a very kind of common vocabulary word in the language of ATLS. We kind of referred to the language of ATLS in the first podcast and how it is somewhat universal. And so it's important to understand what that means, a definitive airway. Definitive airway is a tube placed in the trachea with a cuff inflated below the vocal cords with that tube connected to some sort of a oxygen-enriched environment here. And I think one of the most important things, at least it was in my experience in Afghanistan, was the airway is secured in place with an appropriate stabilizing method. So why do I key in on that of all things here? Well, listen, unless they're just going to die on the table, all trauma patients must be moved. And so it's critical that you have, again, you get ahead of the patient there and you think of not just applying the adjunct, but now that it's applied and I see that it's working, how am I going to secure that? Now, when it comes to airway, I think the classic way that we've seen before is tape. And we had no shortage of 3-inch medical tape in our aid station in Afghanistan, because I'll tell you what, you put enough 3-inch medical tape on something and it's not going to move at all. But when we're talking about airway and stabilizing that definitive airway, we worry and we're concerned about how secure is that tape on this area of the body where it's like you have all these weird contours to the face, and now we're sticking tape maybe to the face. Are we going to cause skin breakdown? Is it even going to hold that tube very well? There are many, many commercial devices out there for stabilizing airways. And I think if you're going to be in the airway game, it's something to consider. Hey, am I doing a good enough job of stabilizing this airway with just tape, or do I need to look into some sort of commercially produced stabilizing method?
I would 100% agree on that. And commercial devices are cheap enough. Your department should be willing to buy it without issue. I mean, this is one of those things that I feel like unless you're in a truly austere environment or in extreme conditions, commercial devices should be readily available.
Yeah, I agree. And it's the A of A, B, C, D, E. We just talked about how if A's broke, it doesn't matter what you do for B, C, D, or E. So yeah, I think the investment here is critical.
Okay, so this kind of leads into the next part about this. What we're trying to do here is we're trying to maintain oxygenation and prevent hypercarbia, because these are critical issues that come up with trauma patients, especially those with head injuries. And we've talked about how that hypercarbia is an important role there. So that excess CO2. So we want to make sure that we're controlling that. So while we are controlling the airway, we need to make sure that we're doing the appropriate things to keep homeostasis, if you will.
Right. And so often that comes with your intubation if you need to. But something to consider are alternative ways to obtaining the definitive airway. And so this is where things like cricothyroidotomy and tracheostomy come into place. I think that a lot of us are trained in crics. And if we're talking about damage control, just getting a tube in there and making sure that this person has an airway that is patent and that you can ventilate through, I think cric is the way to go. It's fast. There's less bleeding involved, and you can do it with very little equipment. There are special kits you can buy, but in the end, if you've got a scalpel and some hooks, then you're pretty good to go with a cric. You can do it with some basic equipment here.
What my personal technique on this, and I think is one that's pretty widely advocated, I know that hooks are kind of like the traditional in some ways, because I feel like the military advocated for that more and kind of older airway. But what I actually do is called the scalpel finger bougie, because all I need are four basic things. I need a bougie. I need the size 6-0 tube roughly that's cuffed, given that size may vary a little bit depending on what your issue is. But I also need a scalpel, usually an 11 blade is still kind of the one that I tend to go towards more. And then I need my finger. And that's all I actually need to control that airway. And the technique itself, we could dive into a whole lot of detail, but I'm actually going to include in the show notes links to stuff from Scott Weingart, because I think he does an excellent job. And I think it's a great way that if you want that specific information, you can dive off into that specific corner. If this is something that you already feel relatively comfortable with, you don't lose time here for that. But I think the other important thing to talk about here is when someone would need a trach or a cric. And the way I think about that is CAICO, or can't intubate, can't oxygenate. So ultimately, at its core, if someone is in this situation where you cannot successfully pass an endotracheal tube, that definitive airway, it can't go through the cords in the traditional method, and you have someone that you cannot oxygenate otherwise. So this is not someone you can just put a non-rebreather on, or is someone who you can maybe sneak away with a like some sort of supraglottic airway or bagging them or something like that. They need to have some form of truly definitive airway, and they need it now. Then you have reached KYCO. And I think about this the same way that Baltimore Shock Trauma has talked about this, and others like the Vortex approach has covered this as well. And there's essentially like three components to this. The first is that you're going to try and do your endotracheal intubation. That's usually your first up. Now, you don't have to follow it in any specific order, and you don't have to do it exactly this way. This is meant more as a guide. But I will attempt up to three intubations. Fortunately, I really haven't been put like so much in those situations, but that's my cutoff, because literature has shown that basically once you're past the third attempt, you're not really going to get it, and you're delaying the inevitable, and you're increasing the risk of death and other complications. So for me, I've got up to three attempts. Now, that's not meaning I'm going to do the exact same thing three times. That means I'm going to do something different. I'm going to improve my technique in some form or fashion, however way I can, to optimize that approach and successfully passing that intracheal tube. That's my up to number. If I've got someone who, hey, after one attempt, I look and I thought, well, hell, there is no way I'm going to pass the tube this way, then I'm going to move on to the next approach. The one that I consider kind of optional, because again, you may see something when you're looking at the airway that you're thinking this is not going to help the situation either, but you could place a supraglottic airway. I prefer supraglottic airways that I can intubate through, which means that I can pass a gum elastic bougie through the tube. It will go through the cords, and then I can exchange that out with an endotracheal tube. And this is something that is not that hard to do. It does take some practice to get used to it, and this is something you need to practice before you're actually put in this situation, but it is highly beneficial. And then if those two things don't work, or like I said, they're not applicable for your situation, you move straight to a surgical airway. This is not one of those times where you debate and you go on. This is where people die if you do not establish this definitive airway early. So I am ready. Scalpel finger bougie. Like Mike alluded to, there are commercial products out there, but I would highly encourage you to get good at one of these. And if I could only pick one, I'm going to pick that one, because I should have those resources anywhere that I'm going to be. Whereas the commercial devices, I may not have them at that facility or in that exact environment.
Yeah, it's a hell of a thing to be trained with a special device. And when you need it the most, someone tells you, oh, hey, we're out. You know, or they stop making that device. You're like, well, shoot, well, now what do I do? Yeah, there's scalpels everywhere. There's tubes everywhere. Very little extra equipment required than stuff that if you're in a halfway decently supplied environment, you're going to have those things you need.
I also want to cover something else here, and I may be getting ahead of us a little bit, but I think it's worth talking about in this same time frame. But you know, sometimes you have to do a surgical airway because of the environment that the patient is. Maybe they have limited neck range of motion. You're like have true concern for a spinal injury. Direct laryngoscopy can be very difficult to perform well in those environments. So I prefer video laryngoscopy, and I prefer hyperangulated, especially in these situations, which I know there's controversy out there. I feel like the evidence has been catching up to support my view on this as well, especially when you're talking about like trauma and other kind of unique environments. But I use the hyperangulated video laryngoscopes like the traditional GlideScope. And since you mentioned like specialized equipment here for a second, I feel like this is a natural way to get into this, is I'm using that because it allows me to keep that person in pretty strict C-spine precautions while still being able to pass that airway. But I also recognize that if I'm in an austere environment where I don't have the resources I need to do that appropriately, that I am going to be at an even lower threshold to perform a surgical crike because I'm in that situation.
medicine is such a risks and balances kind of a situation where everything you do to help the patient potentially has a thing that could hurt the patient. And this is emphasized here in the ATLS manual. It says, because all of these actions, so all of these intubation actions we're going to do, whether it's with, you know, our DL or our VL or putting in other devices we're going to hit on later, potentially require neck motion. Restriction of cervical spine motion is necessary in all trauma patients at risk for spinal injury until it has been excluded by appropriate radiographic adjuncts and clinical evaluation. Now, radiographic adjuncts, I talked about that. I had no radiographic adjuncts over there in Afghanistan. The brilliant one we did one time was, we're like, I wonder if the guy has a bullet in his neck. And someone had the great idea of, let's go get the metal detector wand from the front gate.
Holy
and let's
shit.
Wand this guy. And sure enough, boop, it beeped when we waved it over the guy's neck. And we're like, okay, I guess he's got a bullet in his neck. And that changed our way we're going to transport and treat this guy. So yeah, when you're in austere environments, the radiographic adjuncts are not going to be there. You're going to have to go with your clinical evaluation. And sometimes it comes down to this difficult situation of, look, if this guy can't have a patent airway, what does it matter if I preserved his C-spine motion? He's just going to die here on the table. So sometimes you have to do these things when you're in resource-poor environments to get your A down and then work on B through E later on.
That's some MacGyver shit right there. that's pretty awesome. Now, I would also say that this is one more reason why you should have POCUS at the bedside, because you can help confirm your placement there. Notice how I incorporated that in. Once again, I'm a huge POCUS advocate. But I would really agree the importance of being able to have a way to safely and effectively secure that airway. But I think something else we need to kind of talk about here for a second are the hop killers. And how we can't assume that our abusive, belligerent, excited delirium type patients are intoxicated or under the influence of certain substances, because these patients can actually be hypoxic and can be acting this way. So we want to make sure that we can give them oxygen as quickly as possible. And one of my favorite things in excited delirium, this is a bit of a side topic here, but I think ties in well, is if I've got someone in excited delirium, as we're getting them under control, I will actually grab a non-rebreather, shove it over their face, because it does two things. It creates basically a spit mask. And if that person has an oxygenation issue, I've got tons of oxygen going to their face. Whether I can at least help that in some degree, that's going to be something that I at least have on hand that is very quick and easy to do, if nothing else.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I like that a lot. It does a double function. It protects you, it protects the patient as well. And these are patients where you may have to kind of put them down and own their airway when they're so out of their mind, so to speak, that they can't cooperate with their care. This is one of the times where you might have to sedate them and own that airway.
So I mentioned briefly the hop killers, and I think this is something that we need to talk about at least at some point in our ramblings of airway and ventilatory management goes. And that is, what are they and why are they so important? In trauma, a lot of times you're going to have at least one of these factors involved, and you need to be able to recognize it, because if you fail to recognize and correct it as much as possible before the airway, you will kill them. So the three hop killers: hemodynamics, oxygenation, and pH. pH meaning acidosis. So hemodynamics, this person is hemodynamically unstable. They've got a blood pressure that's trending down. They've got uncontrolled issues with bleeding, or they have something else that's going on that, again, if you do not control that in a timely fashion, especially before you tube them, you're going to kill them. Because if, for example, I have someone who already has a soft blood pressure, who has been bleeding heavily, both internally and externally, and then I decide, you know what, we need to go ahead and tube this person now, without really taking the time to give them blood products, try and correct their blood pressure, try and stabilize them other ways. When I relax them that much more, and given there are some medications that can help you through this, all I'm going to do is make the situation worse hemodynamically, and there's a pretty good chance I'll kill them. Same thing with oxygenation. If they already have low oxygen saturations and it's been difficult, let's say I've been going to town with the BBM and I'm at 15 liters per minute. Hell, I've actually gone way past that mark and I've gone flushed with the device, which a lot of times check your local systems, but you can actually flush up to 60 to 80 liters per minute. So let's say I'm doing that and I'm still having issues with getting that person's oxygen saturations up, I may need to do something else, like, you know, maybe correct the pneumothorax that's causing this. Because if I don't, when I am now trying to intubate them without correcting those issues, that oxygenation is going to just keep dropping. Even with apneic oxygenation in place, if I'm not addressing the underlying concerns there, they can still potentially trend down, given it's harder if you do this all correctly, but they can trend down. And then again, you have a hypoxemic cardiac arrest. And then the final one, acidosis, which can sometimes be hard for us to really know, especially if you don't have like an ABG or VBG readily at hand, but can sometimes kind of tell based on what's going on in the environment. If I'm not correcting the factors that can contribute to acidosis, when they are retaining CO2 because they're not actively breathing, that gets worse, especially if I have these long intubation attempts. So maybe I couldn't pass the tube the first time, or I've been, you know, screwing around with the airway, trying to look and look and look and look and look and not really doing anything else. That CO2 keeps rising and they're already in a delicate state. That's another great way to kill someone quickly.
Yeah, it's critical. The resuscitate, then intubate approach is really important versus just taking over the airway and saying, I got to intubate this person right now. Well, do you? Let's think about that and think about the negative consequences of owning that airway a little bit too early.
And I have a whole RTI podcast that I'm going to include in the show notes.
Oh, great. I love that. Well, let's say you've made the decision to intubate someone or otherwise establish a definitive airway here. You're going to be asked by your instructor on the test, and you'll also need to establish that you did a good job with making that patent airway. So what are you looking for here? There's a couple of things you're looking for. The classic one is there symmetrical rise and fall of the chest and adequate chest wall excursion? So could you have done a little mainstem bronchus intubation and gone too far one way? You might have to pull out the tube if all you see is one lung inflating here. You're going to listen for movement of air in both sides of the chest. Now, that can be hard in our austere or our otherwise loud environments there, but you're going to do your best to listen for air movement. It's great to have a pulse oximeter, so that's awesome to have to gauge your peripheral perfusion. We mentioned that with palpate and the radial pulse. The downfall there is we might not measure how well we're ventilating that person, which we're going to get to that later on. And lastly, capnography. So capnography is kind of the next step beyond like a colorimeter. You know, I think a lot of places are used to having a little purple and yellow rectangle you plug in on top of your BVM, and that will change color when it's exposed to carbon dioxide. And that can be your key to know, oh, hey, there you go. I'm getting carbon dioxide back. That means air is going in, CO2 is going out. Hey, I think I'm in the right place here. But the problem there is that, well, what if you've got too much carbon dioxide, hypercarbia? Your colorimeter cannot detect that. And so that's why capnography is key and really getting your CO2 dialed in just so, beyond just colorimetry.
The other thing, I just want to emphasize what Mike has talked about. Waveform capnography should be what we're doing. And I know sometimes departments and culture is really hard to change, but we need to get away from simple color change. We need to be able to actually see waveforms because they give us so much more information. And we have to understand that each one of the things Mike and I just talked about are not perfect, especially by themselves. You need to be confirming the airway placement with as many different ways as possible to help confirm that not only did you get proper placement, but that you're getting adequate ventilation.
Yeah, I think it's like any other physical exam test you do on somebody here. If I'm looking at someone who's got a bad belly, like, yeah, that rebound tenorus is interesting over the right lower quadrant here, but maybe I'll try a Rovsing. Maybe I'll try other stuff. If I'm kind of not quite sure, I'll try other provocative maneuvers to try to elicit what I'm looking for here. The same sort of thing goes with making sure your airway is working. There are multiple ways to assess that. So use them all and really be confident that you've got that airway working. Because again, it's A. You got to get A down before you get to B.
All right. So something else that we probably should have mentioned earlier that I think is worth tying in as we're looking through the notes here is a couple of situations where we really need to think about who we should be intubating. So classically, you're going to hear that phrase GCS less than 8 intubate is helpful, but should not be the decision maker by itself, because again, you can have a GCS higher than that, a Glasgow Coma Scale higher than that, that would still warrant intubation. And sometimes I have people who are not intubating simply because the GCS was not 8 or less. And then I've had other ones, including a situation not that long ago, where I am literally talking to the medic on the phone, and they said, yeah, the GCS was 5, and now it's down to 3, and I'm bagging them. I'm like, okay, do you have airway supplies? And trying to figure out, like, okay, why have they not intubated this person? And come to find out once they get there is that they were concerned. They were nervous with the idea of intubating by themselves, which I appreciate, but at the same time, it's something that, you know, you need to have some kind of airway placement, even if that meant having a supraglottic airway temporarily. That's key, because also, while a patient may have a GCS less than 8, the other thing I want to look at is how are they breathing? And his thought was that, well, they're still breathing okay. But I'm like, yeah, but are they really protecting their airway at all? The same thing, a lot of times people talk about gag reflex. I'm not a huge fan of looking at the gag reflex as a way of being able to tell if they can protect their airway, because there have been some studies shown that some people have an intact gag reflex and still have issues with airway control. And then some people just don't really have a gag reflex at baseline. So are you going to intubate anyone because they don't have a gag reflex? Even if there was nothing else that had you concerned, that's why I'm not a big fan of the gag reflex, just like I am not a big fan of the GCS by itself. The one that I will say it's pretty straightforward is if the patient's apneic, they probably need intubated.
That's brilliant.
Because they're
probably
not going to do much by themselves.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you get that response of, well, they're breathing okay with a GCS of 5 or lower, then the question is like, are they really? Like, what's the point of breathing? We're trying to get O's to the organs. And if someone's GCS is below 8, then whatever movements the person is doing with their mouth and their chest wall are apparently not adequate for whatever reason to get those O's to the brain to make things work well. So yeah, I would definitely have a conversation with that person to be like, you know, just that movement of the respiratory organs is not enough to say they're breathing, quote, okay.
So let's talk about a few airway adjuncts here real quick, just because I think we need to talk about things besides, you know, tubes, at least your classic tubes, right? One of the biggest ones, nasopharyngeal airways, the little, you know, often green colored tubes that you stick in someone's nose. I don't think we have the time to really talk about the actual technique, and it's easy enough to find, especially in your like ATLS books, and there's videos behind it and stuff like that, which I can all include as well if need be. But do not place an NPA, a nasopharyngeal airway, if there's any suspected or potential cribriform plate fracture. I'd rather do other things instead to avoid that potential complication. The next one that I throw out there is the oral pharyngeal airway. Traditionally, we talk about maybe not using this in children, at least with the traditional technique, because it can cause damage to the mouth and pharynx. And that's because there's like this twisting motion that you do as you set it down. However, one of the newer things is starting to place a tongue blade. So you grab your tongue depressor or tongue blade and you use that to assist placing the oral pharyngeal airway. Keep in mind that if this person has a gag reflux, this can cause vomiting and aspiration. So I am very hesitant on doing this unless they really need that there to help open up the airway enough to facilitate the process to get them intubated. And then there are laryngeal mask airways or intubating laryngeal mask airways or the eye gel or any of those types of things. They can be used. These supraglottic airways are really helpful. King LT is another common one. And then the last one is the combi tube. Now, all of these can be placed without having to directly visualize, and they're pretty straightforward. The combi tube was the first one, as a quick side note, that I trained on. And the combi tube is the only one that it does not matter where the tube actually rests, right, because it has two separate lumens, as far as like one is directed towards what would be if you put it in the esophagus, towards the esophagus, because it's assuming that if it tracks somehow up into the cords, which by the way is incredibly hard to do, but they claim like 10% of the time it happens, you can now ventilate through it. And then if it's sitting in the esophagus, like traditionally it does, there's a little porthole that blows out and secures oxygen going past the cords, assuming that the cords are open enough. There's not a lot of edema or other issues that arise from it. So the combi tube, when I learned about it, was quote unquote firefighter proof, because no matter where that tube went, you could ventilate, in theory at least.
Yeah, back in the day, a lot of my medics had the King LT laryngotracheal tube as well. So yeah, a lot of great adjuncts out there that, you know, again, if we need to get the airway going, and sometimes a person needs airway help out in the field, well away from the nice, well-lit, air-conditioned setting with a nice table that you can elevate up to your waist height for traditional endocrational intubation. And so it's great to have these out in the field in more austere environments where maybe you don't have either the skill or just the resources to be able to, you know, the traditional see the cords, pass the cords intubation here.
One thing I'd like to just add to that real quick is the AirQ. That's a newer one that's out there. This is one that I've been picking up more, and I have no conflicts of interest. I don't get money from any of these people. If I did, I maybe not need the podcast to start with. But, you know, the AirQ I've really liked because all of them I can intubate through with a gum elastic bougie, and it has all sizes. I mean, we have the tiniest of tiny newborn, even like preemie neonatal size, all the way up to the big boy and everything in between. And it works really well. It's easy to do. And like I said, I can intubate through it. A lot of these supraglottic airways, you can't intubate through. And I think that's a vital thing to remember, because this is something that will come up, is that why put a supraglottic airway there if you can't keep it long-term and you can't intubate through it to make that exchange just a little bit safer.
Yeah, the IGL is another one that is up and coming, and there are different ones you can or cannot intubate through. So important to know that before you get into that situation there. But yeah, I totally agree. You don't want to put something in, just have to pull it out again and then try your other method of definitive airway control.
All right. So we're getting kind of towards the end here. There are some other things that are worth emphasizing here briefly. Mike, do you want to kind of start in on those?
Yeah, so you mentioned a lot the gum elastic bougie. And so during your practical part of ATLS, you might be asked, well, hey, how do you know that this is going well as far as you're in the right position here? The key there, of course, is feeling the subtle clicks as you insert the gum elastic bougie. That kind of hockey stick-shaped tip is supposed to rub along the tracheal rings. And that's going to be in the vast majority of your placements here. And so if you are in the right place in the trachea, you're going to feel that click, 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 click as you go down the tracheal rings. If you're in the esophagus, the idea here is what you hear is nothing, right? Because it's just a smooth esophagus there. So that's going to be your key to, you know, verbalize when you're doing the practical, and your key to feel for when you're doing this for real is the tracheal rings.
And it's going to be less of a hear and more of a very soft feel. You'll feel kind of like the little resistance and the clicking like Mike's talking about. But the other thing that you can do is what's called the hold up sign. So as you get to the level of the carina, it's not really going to pass, at least not easily anymore, to that point. And so a hold up sign is another way to help confirm that you're in the trachea and now down to the level of the carina. But in theory, if you're going to the esophagus, you're just going to be able to keep feeding that through. And it's going to feed through a lot more than if you were in the airway like you're supposed to be.
Oh, that's great. I like that a lot. Yeah. Yeah, definitely the click was more of a tactile clicking than an auditory clicking for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, especially in a loud trauma bay. Yes, you're going to be feeling that and not hearing it. That's definite. Now, like I mentioned before, this patient is going to have to be moved. So before you move them, secure whatever adjunct you use. After you move them, reassess every little thing you've done. When it comes to the airway and your definitive airway here, after you move the patient, you're going to reassess tube placement. What are you going to do? You're going to, of course, look for all those things we mentioned as far as, you know, is there a good equal rise and fall of the chest? You're going to auscultate both lung fields just to make sure, again, you have equal rise and fall and equal air movement there, and that you haven't maybe advanced that tube too far during the movement of this patient. And you're checking, of course, for your capnography. Hopefully, you don't just have colorimetry there. Hopefully, you have good capno.
One thing with drugs here, real quick, there's now what's called drug-assisted intubation versus like your RSI, your rapid sequence intubation or induction. The things I'd like to point out here real quick is, I mean, you could pick any number of drugs, but I'm a huge fan of ketamine because it's more hemodynamically stable. It's easy to dose. If you give too much, it's really not that big of a deal because you're just going to sedate them for longer. It's easy enough to give both as a bolus and a drip. I'm a huge fan of that, given there are plenty of other drugs that you could use. The one that I think is worth really diving into when it comes to paralytics is succinylcholine. I am not a fan of succinylcholine. The one benefit is for certain situations, like if I have a hip dislocation or a really tough shoulder dislocation or stuff like that, we might use just a tiny bit of sucks to help relax them. Or if you have laryngospasm from ketamine when you're doing conscious sedation, like there are certain fine situations where I'm still using sucks, but it's rare. What I'm now using is usually rocuronium because it avoids a lot of the potential contraindications and complications that arise with succinylcholine because it can cause extreme hyperkalemia. And there's a whole bunch of things you have to remember. And some of it you won't know until you get labs back, which if you really had to get a definitive airway quickly, you want to have that airway established before then. So I'm not going to wait for the labs. So for me, rocuronium, easy. It provides a longer period of time where they're paralyzed, which isn't necessarily a bad thing as long as you're doing everything else like sedation properly. But for me, I've become less a fan of a sux, and I have become more a fan of rocuronium or similar agents because there have been issues with shortages. So I've had to use like vecuronium instead.
Yeah, during this COVID era, people are running out of things to use for these drug-assisted intubations. So it's nice to know what your first choice would be, your second choice, and know all of these risk benefits for the different agents if you have to use one you're not as comfortable with.
And another one that we could dive into really quickly is it is incredibly important. I cannot emphasize this enough to have proper post-intubation sedation. Like I said, ketamine is going to be a big one because I can induce with it and then I can provide that sedation afterwards. But also fentanyl is a wonderful drug. Easy to dose, easy to bolus, easy to increase the drip. And it's preferred in head trauma situations too, because you can give a lot of it. We're talking about like 2 to 5 micrograms per kilogram as far as dosing goes. So I am pretty liberal on the fentanyl, assuming hemodynamically they're okay. But I've noticed it affects hemodynamics less than, say, like morphine or hydromorphone.
I like fentanyl a lot. And like you said, you're already getting the airway in. That's one of the biggest things, that and hemodynamics, when you're dealing with some of these opioid pain medications. So yeah, fentanyl dings the hemodynamics a little bit less. So if you put a little bit too much in, you just kind of maintain the oxygenation and ventilation a bit longer, and you're good to go there.
The last thing I just want to briefly touch about, because I'm going to share it in the show notes, is another great Scott Weingart post, and that is about the Kovach Kata. And this is talking about like the steps to take to get you through the airway, especially if you're having a difficult airway. And we could talk about that a whole lot more, but I think they've done a really good job summarizing it. And like I said, some people who are listening to this, you may already feel excellent about the airway. And so you may not need all those details, but I want to give you an additional resource to follow up on if you're wanting to improve on your airway management skills.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, we'll look for that in the show notes.
All right, Mike, I think we have pounded all through. We've done great. We kept it right around like 45 minutes or so. So long, like always, because we have so much to cover, but not terrible.
No, I agree. If I can, I'll just sum up kind of the key points here at the very end. Again, the words used in ATLS manual are must administer oxygen to severely injured trauma patients. I'd say strongly consider is the way we should go there, and be careful about those hyperoxic injuries you can have in all kinds of acute care situations here. You're going to want to watch out for C-spine injuries and make sure you are stabilizing C-spine, and be careful as far as considering your adjuncts there. Also considering damage to the nose and to the mouth as far as considering which kind of definitive airways you want to put in. At the very end there, you mentioned too about the drugs, knowing the different indications, contraindications of your drugs and all your other adjuncts to be used during obtaining your A, your first part of your A, B, C, D, E.
Thank you so much for that wrap up, Mike. And now can you go ahead and give us the tagline?
I couldn't be happier. Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.